What if every student had a tutor and personalized learning was available to everyone? What if every family had a financial guide and their investments made for an optimistic future? What if every doctor could diagnose you in seconds and healthcare visits felt more personal? What if your business never slept and every customer's shopping experience felt like it was designed especially for them? It can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
What does possibility mean to you?
That's a hard question.
Something that you can strive for.
That I'm able to do anything I set my mind to.
You're confident in yourself and you believe in yourself. Stuff that you could achieve.
I feel excited. Anything is possible when you're more confident.
Shoes are a huge part of that. They are the most important part of my style.
You can like express yourself
in the right shoes.
Anything is possible.
DSW, countless shoes at bragworthy prices. Imagine the possibilities.
NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 8, Episode 12. This episode was titled Dearest Brenda, and my lovely wife, Becky, played the part of Deborah in this episode, reading the letter. So I forgot to mention that in the credits of the episode, but hopefully you all enjoyed that. We tried to mix things up a little bit so you didn't hear me reading a woman's voice. We covered kind of a lot and nothing all at the same time in this episode. I found it to be kind of an interesting one. But sitting across from me at the table here, I have to give his take on it, Mr. Zach Weaver.
Hey, hey.
And of course, my right-hand man sitting directly to my right, as always, is our executive producer, editor extraordinaire, Mr. Mike Bussing.
Hey.
And since the gang's all here, let's go ahead and get started.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You were up at 4, baking pastries at 5, and open at 6. 100th cappuccino by 8, 200th customer by 9, and there's still 12 hours to go. That's why you need a business broadband that works as hard as you do. Introducing Sky Business. With 4G internet backup and our Stay Connected guarantee, that's better business. To find out more, visit skybusiness.com. Sky Fiber only, 30-second 4G activation or one-off credit. New customers, Pro Plus packs only. T's and C's apply.
All right, before we get into the listener questions this week, Zach, your thoughts on the episode?
It was nice to hear the letter to kind of get some insight on how Deborah was feeling mm-hmm. towards everybody.
Right.
You never know with mood swings how she could be feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time of the letter, it seemed she was very positive, very upbeat, and very wanting to bring the family back together. Because from this point, we know that Brenda has kind of been, I don't want to say excommunicated, but it kind of sounds like she's almost excommunicated at this point.
I think she's more excommunicated herself. But I think that was the other, for me, another benefit of the letter was getting a look at, kind of a third-party look at the relationship between Agnes and Brenda.
No, I have to agree that the outside look really helped kind of bring some things together for me. Past the note in the episode, we talked about the font, and I think that was groundbreaking to see mm-hmm. that the font possibly matched. And then in the episode, you talked about that this is it. You thought she was guilty because of
right.
this. Which I think, I mean, that could have been a huge thing right there.
Yeah, and there were a lot of people on the fan page, and I wanted to, you know, obviously when we're writing those episodes, we're trying to be concise and tell a story, and this, mm-hmm. and this is our place where we get to break things down a little bit more. And there were some people that were like, I can't believe that just based on font, Bob was ready to write her off.
Yeah, so obviously a lot of the listeners know that I've leaned towards her probably being guilty.
Uh-huh.
But I was even a little alarmed that that was kind of your tipping point.
So, right. So to expand upon that. You know, there were, first of all, if you didn't quite catch where I was coming from in the episode, the issue was that mind you, I didn't know the default font was that. So, mm-hmm. so let's start there. Is when I saw the note, I immediately thought, wow, that's more of a unique choice for as far as font than I thought. Because not only is the Times New Roman, but it's tiny, it's small, very mm-hmm. small font. Or at least I found it to be very small font. And so I'm like, oh, so that, my first thought was, oh, I bet it didn't come from the Courtney's computer because that's not the default. That's not what Agnes typed with. So it probably, this is probably a good indication it didn't come from their computer. And so I had in my mind that this is a very unique setting for someone to set, because I had weird margins compared Ooh. To now. Because now kind of the typical is again, 1-inch margins and like an 11 or 12 point font. And it had like 1 1/4-inch big margins in the small font. So I have in my mind that this is an incredibly unique choice to type with these settings. And then I find the Dearest Brenda letter and I read it through a few times. And then I'm looking, I'm like, man, that's small too. And I scale it. And I realize, oh my goodness, it is the exact same settings as that. So, in my mind, remember at that point, as far as I knew, those were not default settings. Someone, that was their preference, went in and changed the settings to this small font and big margins. And then I see this note written by Deb on that computer, and it was put into the same exact, in my mind again, strange settings. So that was too much of a coincidence for me. And when I say that the season would end, I still, we're not talking about it right now until we get more information, and I'm working on that as we speak, but there's still big issues that I have with timing, regardless. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for me to see how Deb could have been involved in these murders based on, when did Agnes die and when do we know Deb was gone, with those two things. So those things were still going to happen in the background. But what I was saying as far as the season ending is I'm not going to devote all of my time and waste your time, the listeners, to hear me continue trying to see if maybe Deb has an alibi when there is a large piece of evidence that's pointed right at her, aside from the blood, but now the font thing right at her. So that's kind of where I was coming from. And then the way the episode framed, I hope everybody enjoyed the listen and found it interesting and educational, but it was kind of, I was writing the episode already and framing it for that reveal. And then I got the note, saw the post and dug in a little further and found out, oh, that's not only the default on the Courtney's machine, at least the factory default, not that they couldn't have changed it, but not only is that the default on their machine, it's the default on damn near every machine. Mm-hmm. I would say most machines.
And the copy and paste idea at the end of the episode is huge and makes a lot of sense because I remember it still does that if you do it today.
Does it?
If you copy a text from a website, from an email, whatever it was.
And you paste it in.
And paste it in. It will keep the font and the size.
Right.
So, I mean, that makes perfect sense that maybe that was her email server was that font mm-hmm. and size. And she just copied and pasted it.
And there's been, I've been pretty busy this week, but on the fan page, it seems like people are, kind of mixed on that. Some people are saying it doesn't do it. Some people are saying it does do it. Depends on that. So I don't have a 100% answer for you yet if that's exactly what happened. But that when I did it on my computer here, same, which is completely different software, but it did that. And I feel like I remember it always doing it because I remember, like writing papers or writing letters and then like copying and pasting something for part of it from an email. It would drive me nuts because that section would be in a different.
Yeah, then you have to reformat that section back to the other part.
Yeah. So, that was interesting. The font, people have done more work, people have been emailing me and stuff and showing me that, there's all kinds of, I wouldn't say stats, but a lot of information that apparently when Windows 2000 came out, it was extremely expensive. It was like $400 or $200-some to upgrade. Mm-hmm. And so people were either using Microsoft Works or they were the Word 97 hung on for years. Like it sounds like Word 2000 never really got popular because it wasn't good enough as far as improvements to justify spending the hundreds of dollars on it. But it basically just means that, a lot of people, I would say there's probably guessing a 70% chance if you sat down at a computer in 2001 and typed up a note, it would be in those exact settings.
Did you ever think you'd spend this much time talking about a font?
Mm-mm. And I bet the listeners didn't either. I hope people aren't getting frustrated, but this is our process. It just happens to be this is more interesting when we're digging into the details of blood spatter or something like that. as opposed to something like computer font. But it's all necessary. This is why we do what we do. This is why Mike Ware wanted us to take the case, is because he knows that we can bring in all these different perspectives and we can answer these questions. That's what we're trying to do, you know. And I hope that everyone listening is starting to realize that, you know, to trust me in the fact that I don't have an agenda. I'm not trying to prove Deb Perringer innocent or guilty. I'm just trying to find the truth, and the way to the truth is to answer all the questions, fill in the gap, create a clear picture, and then we'll see where that points us. And we're still way down the line in the process of doing that.
All right, we've got two questions here from listener Yuli. Yuli's first question is, after the Dearest Brenda letter, I'm really curious about the daughter's open letter. Do you have it?
I don't. I scoured through the documents, the files, the subfolders, looking for it, and it's just not in there, which is really frustrating. Because what's interesting, Zach, that wasn't on the show, because I didn't notice it until later. I think I saw it, but I didn't really piece it together. So remember I said it was whatever the date was, I think it was October 2nd, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, when Deb sat down and wrote the Dearest Brenda letter, saved it, printed, to send to Brenda.
Mm-hmm.
Then that document was accessed the next day, not written on, but accessed the next day, which means Agnes read the letter.
Or somebody did.
Right, yeah, somebody at the computer. Well, but then within, I don't remember the time frame, but I mean, it's within minutes, Agnes creates the file, open letter to daughters. So it seems as though Agnes read the letter that Deb had written to Brenda and then responded to that by writing a letter to both daughters, like immediately afterward.
Hmm.
And I would love to know what it says. I don't have it. I will say this, I guess I'll put it out there now. I said in last week's episode, we were going to start covering Deb's trial testimony this week. And I know a lot of you are itching to get into it. And we're going to get there, but we're not going to get into it this week, because in that search, I found another set of documents written by Agnes, and they are very, very interesting, and timing-wise and as far as the course of investigation, they need to come next. We need to go through these documents before we move any further. So that's what's going to be coming this weekend.
All right, Yuli's next question. Are we sure Deborah ever mailed the letter to Brenda?
We're not. You know, that's something that I want to write and ask Deb about, if she ever sent it. But right now, Deb is, I don't know what's going on. There's some listeners that keep regular correspondence with her. And she had told me she was going to write me another letter, and none of us had heard anything for a little while. And then looking at the TDCJ website, it says, at least as of last week, it says that her location is the hospital. So. She's not, so nobody knows. I've talked to Allison. She was going to try to do some checking. Then I've talked to her her cousin, Judge, to see if she can figure out. Nobody seems to know what's going on. All we know is she's not in the prison right now, or at least as of last week, not in the prison, and rather she's in the hospital. So hopefully she's okay and everything gets straightened out. And then on top of that, once hopefully everything's okay, then I will ask her that question to see whatever happened with it.
You know, that was one thing, and I hate to speculate with the letter, being that there was some redacted portions, but, you know, I mean, that could be something along the lines of she was either in rehab or institutionalized, or, you know what I mean? There's something there, because the way it's even framed, even being redacted, you can tell that she was somewhere.
Yeah, and we know that she was in a, I don't want to call it a mental hospital, but she was in a treatment facility.
Mm-hmm.
For her depression.
Mm-hmm.
Around that time. So I think that's what we're talking about. There's weird, and you'll see the stuff we're going to cover this week in Sunday's episode. There's weird redactions, like it appears, and when we read them, I'm just going to have to say redacted because I can't really speculate to exactly what it was. But it appears they were redacting out Angela's name in these documents, which is Deb's daughter.
Okay,
like her name is redacted out of it, but then like the next page, it's not redacted, and then the next page, it is redacted, and then it's really strange. Some of the redactions are weird. But it seems as though they were redacting out, you know, as what I'm hypothesizing based on what we do know, that Deb was at like a psychiatric treatment facility.
Sarah says, there's been a lot of debate as to whether Deb was sincere in her motive for writing the letter. It didn't come off as manipulative to me, but clearly it is open to interpretation. What were your first impressions?
I didn't find it manipulating at all. Self-serving, maybe to some point. You can definitely tell that, in my opinion, she genuinely is trying to repair the relationships in the family. But you can also read in the context of her letter how it always seems to kind of circle back around to her too. You know, so it's you know, I want you to have a relationship with our parents. I know I struggle too. Here's a list of things that I have trouble with that I'd like to see. So it's kind of like she's like venting about her, but then also saying, but we both kind of need to get over this. I don't know. What do you think, Zach?
No, I agree. I think that's exactly spot on, is the fact that I think that it's not trying to manipulate her, but it's definitely, there's some self-serving aspects in there. And it kind of sounds like Deborah's that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, if she's had multiple checks written to her over time and time again, you know, she's worried about number one and that's it.
Yeah, dude, it was, and I don't know if I'd go that far. I just don't know, but I'm telling you, dude, it was a stack of checks that big. Mm-hmm. I'm holding my fingers about an inch apart right now.
So for all of you at home, it's a stack an inch tall.
Right, exactly. 1 inch tall, give or take an eighth of an inch. But it was like we were going through them and it was like a check to AT&T and this is in the bottom Deb's phone bill. And there's, you know, here's a check to Deb and Paul and here's a check for this and a check for that and a check for that. But it sounds like from other documents that they were doing something similar with Brenda. But of course, the state wouldn't. Mm-hmm. They're trying to build a case against Deb. So they're showing all this. What do you think about that? I think that it is counterproductive toward when they're pointing towards more motive. That look at all this money they gave her. She's motivated by money. I look at it like they were her gravy train.
Yeah. No, that does make a good point, because if she was motivated by money, why would she kill them if she's continuing to get money?
Right.
Like she could easily still continue to get money rather than one lump sum out of a will.
Right. Yeah. And obviously maybe, you know, if she's got a couple hundred grand coming to her that, you know, maybe that, you know, that's enticing. But again, it's not. Even a couple hundred grand, that's not, I mean, that's a lot of money, but it's not, that's not lifelong, life-changing money.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, you can, you know, pay your house off. It's just not going to last you for a long time, that amount of money. And then it also takes back to motive, because people have talked about, well, maybe her dad was the target and she had to kill her mom because she was there. And it's like, well, if there's anything or any combination like that, then it takes money out of it again, because the only way she's getting anything from the will is if both are dead.
Mm-hmm.
If you just kill one, that doesn't accomplish anything. So that would mean that it would, you know, there would have to be a premeditation motive to kill both of her parents in order for that to work out. And there's, again, the crime scene, the note, again, I said it before, is the ugly duckling of this case, because there's a lot of things in the crime scene that looks like a heat of the moment, crime of passion type of attack. Or it also could be interpreted as, because, you know, people keep saying overkill, but overkill means they're dead and you keep stabbing them. This wasn't overkill. This was, you know, 75 attempts to kill them before she finally connected. She, whoever, finally connected. But if we're talking about Deb being the perpetrator, it's not overkill. But, you know, it could be interpreted as some of the very personal fit of rage type of thing. But it could also be interpreted as, is a robbery gone wrong? And what, because the things that make it look personal are the same things that would make it look like it was a burglary gone wrong, and that's the fact that it appears to be unplanned.
But then you have the note.
The note throws everything off.
Mm-hmm.
The note makes it premeditated, which doesn't fit with the unplanned nature of the forensics of the attack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have this, and we know, like as I said a couple weeks ago, one thing's for sure, whether it was Deb or somebody else, the note was typed before the murders.
Mm-hmm.
Had a bit, because there was nothing was typed on the Courtney's computer after Agnes got home. We know that for a fact.
Yeah.
So that says premeditation, but the crime doesn't look like premeditation, because, you know, people have said, well, obviously it wouldn't be some killer coming in to kill them because they had to use the frying pans that, you know, they may have had a knife, but that's it. So it could have been, so it must have been Deb. It's like, well, even if it was Deb, It's still because of the note, it has to be premeditated. And she didn't bring. So that argument goes out the window, because whoever it was needed a knife and four frying pans to kill them, and also pre-planned it with, because of the note.
It's very confusing.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait to. I was talking to Jim Clementi last night. We didn't get into this case yet. He's got some stuff, some personal stuff going on right now. So I don't want to bother him with it right now. But as we're getting more of these answers, I want to get him in here and have him profile. And just, even more so than just a profile, but just to talk about and help us understand the behaviors on this crime scene, because my knowledge of criminal behavior analysis is new and limited and based mostly on what I've learned from Jim and from books. And this case doesn't fit any textbook. It's too many weird anomalies for my lack of expertise.
Yeah, and I got to agree. I don't think money was motivation in this whatsoever. I don't know what the motivation would be, but it's definitely, there's some personal hostility in there, and I don't think money had anywhere to play with that, even if it was a robbery gone wrong.
Mm-hmm. I know we've talked about this before, so I don't want to go over and over it again, but you know, the note, again, I always come back to the note in the fact that it, the way it's written, it just doesn't seem, the note is written as though it's to Lloyd,
mm-hmm.
but it's pinned to his dead body, which also doesn't make sense. But we have to remember, the note was typed out previous. So to me, that's an indicator, if we take it on its face value, it's an indicator that whoever did this intended to go into the house and do something, as maybe as revenge to Lloyd, and leave the note for Lloyd to then later find and feel, you know, so like say they were going to come in and kill Agnes,
mm-hmm.
or they were going to go in and attack Agnes, or
just ransack the house.
Right. Yeah. Something like that. But then again, it says you should watch who you let in your door. So like if the note's legit, which I'm leaning towards it's not, but then like what is that? What was the plan? I'm going to come in the door. You're going to let me in, and then I'm going to do something that leaves you to where I can leave this note for you. It's hard to make sense of.
But maybe the watch who you let through the door isn't from that event. Maybe it's from a prior event of somebody that came to service something.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know what I mean? Like somebody came to service, you know, they went to prison, got out of prison. Now they work for X company.
So say, for example, the plumber guy, or the guy plumber. that
comes out, realizes who he is,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, comes up with the attack down the road, you know, a week later or whatever the time frame is.
That would make more sense than, because, you know, my struggle with it is it doesn't make sense the way it was found. Mm-hmm. You don't write a note to a dead person. It's premeditated. It makes sense that it would be that it was planned to be left there for Lloyd to find whatever they did when they got there. But then the opening the door doesn't make sense. And that's the only way it makes sense is what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if it's just like a countermeasure, which let's face it. I mean, as much as, you know, I know there are a lot of people out there, at least some people out there that are really convinced of Deb's guilt. You don't see shit like this.
Yeah.
So a forensic countermeasure, a premeditated. So I'm going to write up this note real quick to have it in my pocket. That's going to point towards some criminal that Lloyd dealt with,
mm-hmm.
to put on him after the murders. That's my plan. Like that is a crazy amount of thought. And if it was done like that, then I think you would expect it to be better thought out.
Well, and thinking out loud, you talking about the target being Agnes, that would make sense with the time of day. If the suspect doesn't realize that Lloyd doesn't work during the day.
Right.
Because, you know, if you ask anybody or say, I'm at work, they assume you work 9 to 5.
Or in the scenario you just laid out, say somebody who'd been in the house,
uh-huh.
say they came in at 2 o'clock someday and dealt with Agnes home. And they said Lloyd's at work. My assumption would be they must work 8 to 5,
mm-hmm.
normal business hours, not knowing they don't go to work until 2 o'clock.
Yeah, especially a 70-year-old man, you wouldn't expect him to work quote unquote second shift.
Right.
So, but that would line that up more with it being an attack on Agnes and he just happened to be there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You don't think that's a legitimate no, do you?
I don't know. I mean, were you listening to this conversation,
Mark? I was, but I was, that's what I'm saying. It's like, it seems like you guys are, it's just like this. I don't know.
The problem is that it doesn't make sense either way. Like my initial thought is, yeah, obviously a forensic countermeasure intended to misdirect police.
Right.
But then it's like, why would it be written that way? Why would it be typed up beforehand and then put, you know.
Because if somebody's planning a murder, it's just a measure they take to try and mislead. They know that they want to try and mislead whoever finds the bodies.
Right. But if you're doing that in a premeditated fashion, I don't think you write a note written to a dead person. You know what I mean? Like you'd write like, haha, fuckers, look what I did in prison. You're next, or something, you know, like something like written to the police, the investigators, or that's what's baffling about it to me is the note is written as though the writer thinks at the end of this attack, Lloyd's going to be alive because they wrote it to Lloyd.
No. Yeah. But I don't think so. I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's what they thought, man. I mean, I think they just needed somebody to talk. They needed somebody to talk to. What sticks out to me, like the main point of the note, is that it shows partially how the attack was done. It shows who did it, which is weird, right? It puts them in connection with
right.
Lloyd. What the note narrates is that Lloyd put me in prison and I came here and killed him. I came through his door. He let me in and I killed him.
Right, which doesn't make sense to do that.
It's admission. No. It's admission for no reason.
And giving the police a direction to go, which is not what you want to do if you're actually that guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's where I'm at with it. Like, I feel like I believe it's a complete forensic countermeasure because it's so odd. And because it's very specific, and it's literally like it's giving the police clues.
Right. Yeah. And I don't disagree with you at all. It's just so complex because there's all these different layers that make also, you know, so say it was someone else, you know, let's leave Deborah out of it. Let's say it's the plumber, you know, the plumber did it. They're just trying to direct the police there. The way it was written and the timing of it, it still doesn't make sense. I definitely think most likely it is a forensic countermeasure because, yeah, you don't point. But then again, we are also putting in our, I guess, intelligence level.
Exactly.
Into the, like, we can look at it and say, stupid can you be
right.
to write a letter saying who did it when you did it? That's dumb. But people do that.
That's the same thing about who you're writing it to.
Right.
Exactly.
Is we say, why would you write it to the person if you killed them? But if you're... True. If you're not there, you were just doing it because you don't have that level of sophistication.
Right.
Tara says, do you know what Deborah is referring to when she states in her letter to Brenda, quote, I am very proud of you. I remember where you came from and where you are now. Is there more info on where Brenda came from?
First of all, I'll say I found that part to be condescending. That means like talking down to you, Zach. But no, that was one of those parts that I was like, ugh. Like I would be so irritated if my brother wrote me something like that. Like, I'm proud of you. Look where you've come from. But again, I'll say again, we're going to learn a little bit more about that on Sunday, but a little more, not as much as we'd like for that particular part of it. But so remember, we have this strange adult adoption. And so my assumption is, and that's all it is that Brenda was in some sort of dire straits at that time. You know, she had gone through divorce. Maybe she was broke. Maybe she didn't have a job. Maybe she was for whatever reason, she was in a bad predicament. And now we see like that Agnes is saying that she's, in the will document, the addendum to the will, that she says that she's financially stable, makes good decisions, and, she's in a financially good position. So that's where I would assume she's going with that she was in bad shape before, and now she's doing well for herself.
Cecilia says, sorry if this was discussed, but for what I remember, Deb used the computer and printer at her work before because she doesn't have one. So why use her parents' computer to write the letter? It looks like a passive-aggressive move.
I don't know. It, unless it has completely escaped my memory, I don't recall any evidence that Deb used a work computer to type on prior to this. And I don't think Deb was employed at this time also.
Carl says, not sure if this has already been stated, but at what age was Brenda adopted to the family? And with all of that, was there any record of past issues with her and the family growing up?
I still don't know when she was adopted. I've seen on some of the TV shows, they say she was adopted at 30. Been told she was adopted at 21. I've heard 25. So honestly, I still don't know the exact date or age she was when she was adopted.
Lynn says, it's been hypothesized that Agnes may have been seeking custody of Angela. Have you uncovered any evidence to support this? It seems like this could cause the intense anger displayed in these murders.
Again, more information coming Sunday, but the short answer is no. There is no evidence whatsoever that Agnes was trying to get Angela. I will confirm that was not happening.
Margie says, is Brenda aware of the podcast and has she made any comment?
I don't know, and no, she hasn't made any comment, at least not to me.
Kim says, Maxine Love stated that the Courtneys financially supported Brenda and Sarah. You had mentioned that you and Allison went to view some of the unreleased evidence while in Fort Worth. Some of this included the cash checks that were issued to Deborah. Were there any there for Brenda? If not, is there anything that indicates they did financially support her? Or is it possible that perhaps Maxine Love got Brenda confused with Deborah?
Well, like we touched on this earlier, you know, there were no checks in the DA's or the clerk's file for checks to Brenda, but that's not surprising. Whether they did exist or not, they were building a case against Deb, so they wouldn't have anything in there for Brenda. But with that being said, as the theme of today's follow-up is, a little bit more on that issue also coming on Sunday.
All right, and our last question comes from Stephanie. She writes, wondering about Brenda's daughter, Sarah. When did her relationship with the Courtneys deteriorate? What type of lifestyle did she have that they opposed so vehemently? And do we know if any people she associated with were potentially drug users, violent criminals, or anything like that?
So this question is a great segue into Sundays, as I've been hinting at all along. We will get the answer to that question and many more on Sunday when we begin the deepest dive we've had so far in the most intricate and interesting look into the victimology of Agnes and Lloyd Courtney. So make sure you tune in for that on Sunday. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by Zach Weaver, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, and Jen Reese in Candela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 per month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. And like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING. And Zach can be found at Z to the Q. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
This has been Truth and Justice.
Okay. All right, man.
We're doing good.
All right.
It's going to lead us right into Sunday's episode, Mikey Mike. Oh, yeah, Mikey Mike and the Funky Bunch, this guy.
I don't know what that means. Yeah, I know. I'm kidding.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.